Hi everyone, good to see you. Blessings. Happy Monday evening. I am Sean Oakes. I am what am I? I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Day to day. But I use the pronouns he and him and they. And my people originally come from England and Spain through the colonial process, and I live in Northern California right now, on the lands of the Southern Pomo peoples, in Western Sonoma County. I'm actually coming to you tonight from the foothills of the Sierra, and out here for a beautiful ancestral skills gathering with my family. So I spent the day making a longbow with a bunch of old archery guys, they were like, "What kind of a hunter are you?" And I was a bit like, "I'm a Buddhist pacifist vegetarian non-hunter, but my kid likes shooting arrows, and I'm going to shoot arrows with him." And they were like, "Great, awesome, you know, how strong is your pull?" Like they just went right into like, "Okay, show me how strong you are." So, good guys. And so I'm taking a momentary break from the backwoods to be here with you, and it's really a pleasure. So, I see a few folks that I know. Good to see you all, whoever you are, and all of you who I haven't met yet. Blessings to you. It's good to see you. If you would like to take a moment and drop any hello and where you're coming from into the chat, please feel free to do that. Our practice tonight will be roughly in the same format that we've been using for the Monday night meditation for nigh on 40 years, something like that. So we'll do meditation together for about a half hour, take a short break. In that meditation, I'll give some instructions and I'll leave a bunch of silence as well. I'll end the meditation with some chanting. And then after a short break, I'll give a bit of a talk. And we'll have some good time for questions and discussion together. So lovely to see some names and locations dropping in. Blessings to a whole bunch of folks up and down the west coast of North America, Turtle Island. Blessings to a couple of folks from far away, Narm in Australia, far up and far north down State College, Pennsylvania. Good to have you. Thanks for staying up late, later on a spring evening. It's great. So, in our practice and our talk tonight, I'm going to look at really the basic mechanisms of meditation, particularly in how we deal with thinking. And I'm going to introduce to us a mnemonic, a way to remember five different methods for dealing with distracting thought that come from the Buddha, come from a discourse of the Buddhas in the middle length discourses. So we'll get there in the talk. And in the meditation, I will offer just a simple grounding and establishing ourselves with an anchor for our meditation. And then a simplified version of a couple of these five tips. So, as Emiko said, welcoming all parts of yourself here. And let's settle in for some practice of meditation together. So, beginning by just finding a comfortable seat. Seat for meditation really means stillness, not so much the sitting posture per se. And so you might be in a sitting posture on a cushion or bench or chair. But you might be in another posture that's better for your body, for some folks lying down, for some folks standing up, other versions of finding stillness could be just right for you. But as you come into stillness, letting your body settle, adjusting, landing here after whatever movement, moving around you've been doing through the day. You find a posture that is easy enough to maintain in stillness for a little while. And as your posture settles in, if you're in any of the upright postures, just feeling the lower half of the body rooted to the ground, feeling where you are, just in this place, feeling the pressure of the body on the cushion or seat. And these sensations that we take for granted because we live in them, but the sensations of gravity and how gravity presses the body to the earth. And this weightiness is itself an anchor, brings us into the here and now with this body and this place and this moment. As the lower half of the body finds its rootedness, its stability, the upper half of the body can be buoyant, light, open. You might lift the sternum at the center of the chest a little, relax the shoulders, soften through the face, and let the head draw back just slightly so it's really balanced over the heart, balanced over the hips. And often, when the upper body comes into a buoyant, tall, upright posture, the breath will deepen. So you may find the breath itself drawing in a little deeper, letting out a little longer. Or do that on purpose if it feels good. Take a full in-breath in and out, long and full. Three times, five times, really using the breath to wash away or set aside anything still lingering from the day so far. And wash the body with clean, new breath energy. And then just settling in to a comfortable breath, pouring into the body and emptying. And with the breath and the sensation of the body sitting, or the body in its posture as the anchor, begin to include a little more of your experience. And just acknowledging your mood, the emotional tone that's present. Maybe give it a name, one or two words at most. And the emotional tone is anything that tells you if there's generally happiness or generally unhappiness, and any detail there. There's some worry or longing, heartbreak, peacefulness. These are all emotional tones. interest, grumpiness. Give your emotional tone a name just so that you can see it more clearly. And then just let it be the feel that's here. If it's really unpleasant, turn your attention towards something more pleasant. Just as an anchor, and let the unpleasantness be there, but in the background. Maybe you bring your attention to the feet on the floor, or the movement of the breath, or just the sense of slowing down and being here can itself be pleasant. And we'll begin meditation just with the intention to be present for what arises, to be here for the shifting emotional tone, for the changing, flickering sensations that pass through, and to do so in a warm-hearted, uncomplicated presence without extra commentary or analysis, without extra thinking, really. Part of planting the intention to be present without extra thinking is simply that it helps us notice when thinking does arise. So we'll begin a meditation just being with the body, breathing, emptying the mind of anything extra, anything left over from the day, any pull toward past and future. We'll take some silence here, settling in to the here and now together. As we sit in meditation with the body and breath, notice that the mind wants to pull away. If it does, it often does. To pull away into story, into words. So initially, just noticing that tendency. Sometimes you notice it just as it begins to turn away from the body and breath, and you can resettle right there. Sometimes we miss that turning away, and the thought just begins, and we catch it mid-sentence or several sentences in. And whenever you notice, just reestablish silence in the mind and the sense of the body and breath just here, and reconnect with the body breathing. Depending on how stirred up the mind is, sometimes we find that we bring it back to the body and breath, and it stays for only a few breaths or a little while, less than a breath, some handful of breaths, and then it goes off again, like the pull is strong. And so, in some meditations, it feels like the mind, the attention just wants to go to story again and again and again. And if this is happening, then we might strengthen the coming back to the body and breath by giving it some thought of its own. So when you bring the attention back to the breathing body, you might say a short phrase like, here and now. You could use Ram Dass's beautiful phrase, be here now. Or you could come back and you could name what's happening here. Sitting. Pressure, feeling the body really pressing into the seat. Breathing in. Breathing out. So you can use words to describe what's here. You can use words to name the intention to be here and now. You could bring in words that add a flavor to the coming back. Words like a loving kindness phrase, a metta phrase. May I be well. Without turning it into an entire metta meditation, you can just use the thought, the wish of well-being, as a way to replace the thought that was wandering away into the future or the past or some complaint. So play with this for a bit. Be here and now with the mind quiet. When you notice the mind pulling away, come back in a way that you're using one of these tools to help stabilize the mind here. Just be here. As we practice with this kind of instruction, what we want is for the instruction to work. And so for the result to be staying longer and longer present without as much distraction, mind wandering away. And so if that's happening, if the pulling away is getting less frequent or less strong, then just stick with what you're doing. Establish attention here with the body and the mind pretty silent. And then just deepen in presence. Let the energy consolidate and stabilize. And keep doing this gentle refocusing as needed, as long as it's generally improving. But if you find that the mind is pulling away a lot, as often happens, and particularly if what the attention is pulling to is a story that has some emotional charge, if there's something going on in your life that's causing some worry or regret or fantasy, often those stories, those thoughts have more energy than the body and breath do. And so they're more interesting. And the body, can't keep the attention settled. The attention is going to go toward what's most intense. And so, if that's happening, then you might move to a different tool and really look at where the mind is going. What is this thought, this story that is pulling at the heart, pulling at the attention? And so the second of the tools is to assess or analyze the thought, particularly for whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. Is this a helpful thought or is it not so helpful? Does it lead to good qualities of the heart and mind or to less skillful qualities of the heart and mind? Very often, if it's a thought that's difficult to set down, something in it is going to be unwholesome. Even just in the basic way of being untimely, if it's not the moment to think about this, even if it's otherwise a good topic, then we need some help to set it down. So if you've got an obsessive story or pattern playing through, stay with it for a bit here. Listen to what it says and see if you can give it a name that describes its emotional tone. What is this story trying to say? What's the feeling behind it? And then see if you can assess whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. Skillful to encourage in this moment, or would it be more skillful to let it go, to set it down in this moment? You can do all of that without a lot of extra thought. It's mostly turning toward feeling. So we're stabilizing if possible. And if not possible, then we're trying to understand what's going on. Sometimes, as we are sensing the feeling tone and the charge behind a thought, it can either be hard to connect with those, or we just start thinking about the story more in a different way. Like it pulls us in to think, oh, what is this? Oh, I'm sad. Or, oh, I'm worried. And then recognizing that I'm worried, it doesn't necessarily bring me out of it. One pathway here is to recognize the feeling, oh, worry, this is worry. And then drop into the body and the energy of worry in the body. And this serves both to recenter us in the here and now, out of the story of the future or whatever the worry was talking about, and into just what's right here. And maybe then I can feel, oh, the ouch of it. Or I can just feel how my body's shaking a little, or numb, or there's a little discomfort of some kind through the tissues. From there, it may be possible to hold that with loving kindness, with compassion for all of the factors and conditions that got us here into this state, into this worry. And not get lost in the story, but really let the breath and the body take care of it. Be right here where you are. If the energy is more intense than you feel like you can easily just rest with, or anytime you want, you could open your eyes, see the space you're in. And let the visual field remind you of the here and now. Again, with the same goal, kind of steady, warm-hearted presence. With the thinking mind quiet. One more tool here. And again, if it's working so far, if the mind is getting quieter and more stable, then just keep doing what you're doing. But if a more forceful recentering feels helpful, then you can bring attention just to your desired anchor, the body breathing, and strengthen your concentration on that. Really just ignore the story that's bothering the mind and think with as much interest and perseverance as you can. Just about this simple body breathing, the breath coming in and out, the body in its life with the earth. And you can hold tight to the breathing body. Like a guide rope through a dark forest. Or along a cliff edge. without looking down or looking around, without letting the attention go to the difficult story. Just put one foot in front of the other on the path. Hold tight to the rope, to the guide, the breath coming in and out. So this is just a little more energy. And so if that feels helpful, play with that. And wherever you are in the process, the goal is to do as little intervention as needed to bring the attention to stability in the here and now, and the mind to a settled, peaceful spaciousness. So we'll practice in silence together from here. To close our sitting, I'll chant a short passage in the Buddhist language of Pali. Some of you will know these chants, some of you may not. And I'll bring them up on the screen. I'll encourage you to follow along. If you want to just stay in meditation, you can just let the ancient words wash over you. This is a chant from the beginning of the morning and evening puja or ceremony that happens every day in the monastic system. And this is a chant to dedicate offerings at the beginning of a practice or the beginning of the ritual part of practice. And you can think of offerings as the kind of symbolic objects you might place on an altar. So, like a candle flame for the clear light of wisdom, a stick of incense or the fragrance of flowers for the scent of virtue, of sila, of keeping the ethical practices. Sometimes there's clear water for the clarity of the heart and mind in meditation. And we make offerings in order to teach our own hearts how to be in wonder and reverence for the world. And to remind ourselves that this path we're on is not just for the relief of stress or the slight reduction in neurotic thinking, although it helps with those things, but that even in the simplest way, bringing loving kindness and focus to the heart mind is part of opening to the deepest mysteries of this human life. And in the Buddhist system, offering our practice in this way, with an understanding that it goes deep, is a beloved reminder. And so these chants are there to remind us that we are practicing for the entirety of our own heart, for all beings everywhere. We remember the beautiful qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the Triple Gem. So we'll sing the dedication of offerings and the homage to the Buddha. Just in Pali, I'll sing them through, and this will be our bell to close the first half of our practice together. When we get to the offerings for each of the Triple Gem, you'll see the word bow. If bowing feels good to you and is part of your practice, and I encourage you to try it on if it's new to you, a gesture of bringing the hands together at the heart and just bowing with respect and reverence to this thing that we are doing, coming together to bring the heart toward deeper and deeper freedom. So, chanting together. Yo so bhagavarahaṃ sammāsambuddho suvākhāto yena bhagavata-dhammo supatipanno yāsa bhagavato-sāvaka-saṅgho Tamahyang Bhagavantang Sadhammang Pachimma janatanu kampa manasa Ime sakare dungata panna karabhute patiganhatu amha kambigaratam hitaya sukhaya arahang samma sambuldo bhagava bundang bhagavantang abhivademi. Suakatom Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami. Supadipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami. Homage to the Buddha 3 times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Good. So let's take five to stretch the body, move around a bit, and we'll meet back here at 10 after the hour for the second part of our circle together. All right, welcome back. Good to see y'all. As you return, and we'll come into the talk. If you're in a place and a mindset where it's easy enough for you to turn your camera on, please do so. It's helpful for me to see that there's human beings out there as I talk, and then you can make like overjoyed or confused faces, or nod appreciatively if I say something that suits your particular mood. Scowl, I might see your scowl if you don't like something. Anyway, it's helpful, if at least, a third of the folks present do so. So thank you for those of you letting yourself be visible here. And for all of y'all, if you put on gallery view and you want to see that there's humans here. There you go. We are in a sort of cosmic way, sitting in a room together, talking about the Dharma. So, thanks for that. So, as we meditate, as of course you know well, we encounter the mind, what we call the mind, and we encounter this activity of the mind, that we maybe too oversimplifyingly call thinking, right? So the cognitive faculties of our beings are immense, and we do so much that falls under the realm of thinking. And in meditation, we can have a kind of complex relationship to thought. On the one hand, thought is considered a sense door, like seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching things. So the cognitive part of our being can be thought of, and can be very helpfully be thought of, as a way that we receive and process information, similar to how we see visible things. If we have eyes that see visible things, we take in light, and we take in color and line, and see forms. So there's, the whole complex process that happens when the sense of sight, for instance, takes in a visible form, an object, something you see, something or somebody. And first of all, your eyeball flips it over, which still blows my mind that everything is actually upside down to how it looks. Don't think about that too hard, but it's true. Visually, that's what's happening. And that then there's this, ex beautiful complex process that happens where understanding comes, where there's a whole process of perceiving and naming and recognizing and figuring out what something is and who we are in relation to it, how close it is, if it's dangerous, whether we like it or dislike it. All of this stuff happens quickly whenever there's sensory perception. And so we take this for granted. Like we're doing this all the time, assessing the world around us, sensing, perceiving, assessing, making choices in relation to it. And we do this through all of the physical senses. You hear something, you have a sense of what it is, where it's coming from, what direction, how far away it is, whether it's an indication of danger, who you are in relation to it. All sorts of recognition and perception happens. And the same with smelling, of course, with tasting, with physically touching things. And with all of these, there can be the sense that there's things that are external to the body. There's things that are outside of myself, and I make contact with them. And, in the Buddha's teachings, there's so much attention given to how we relate to the world around us. So when we see other people, is there liking or disliking? Is there pleasant or unpleasant feeling? Is there wanting? Is there desire? Is there aversion? Is there fear? How we feel about other people, how we feel about places, how the mind, through the sense of seeing something, not just doesn't just see it, but does this whole process around it. So that's true for all of the physical senses. And the cognitive faculty, the mind, is both thought of as a sense, like to have a thought is to sense an idea in a certain way. That can sound strange, but it's interesting to think about it that way, as a sense, that an idea in a certain way is not any more a product of myself than a thing that I'm seeing across the room. I see the pictures on the wall, and I'm clearly not making up the pictures, probably, but I'm not, they're there. And I don't get confused about whether I am the author or of this moment. I am making up the seeing of the pictures, but there is a thing that I'm doing. When I see them, there's a kind of processing. Who I am in relation to the pictures doesn't live in the pictures themselves, right? It lives in my history, my identity, my culture, right? I happen to be in someone else's room. I'm not teaching from home tonight. And so there's some pictures on the wall over here that I've never seen before tonight. And I don't have much relationship with them. But, there's a bunch here that looks sort of Italian and a bunch over there that are like nature watercolors. And some of them are lovely. And, but everything that I think about them has to do with me, who I come from, where I come, what my aesthetic is. These pictures over here on the left are kind of like a kind of thing that my mom really liked. And so I see them, there's a little resonance of mom. Oh, hi, mom. She was from Italy. Her family was from Naples. And I get a little Italian mom side of the family, Naples, like a whole bloom of content, right? Happens. And much of that is me. The others, the nature watercolors, totally different, lovely, not hardly as much emotional response as the others. And again, all of my reaction to nature watercolors, that's all me. And so there's a way that thinking is thought of as, receiving an idea that's not entirely mine, but it also is partly mine. Right? And that's part of what's complex about the cognitive faculty. The part that's not mine, let's do that one first, is that, the ideas that I hold around, these images that look kind of Italian to my perception. Where did those come from? You know, some of those came from my mom, some of those came from just being around lots of kinds of paintings that hang on walls, you know, around here in North America where I live. I've seen things like this before. But all of those ideas, you know, those ideas are in a certain way a continuation of a conversation that's been happening that precedes me by a conversation about art history, conversations about culture, what it means to be, you know, Italian in America. Those are not my original ideas. You know, even my liking or disliking of those things, you know, some of that's sort of maybe unique to me, but some of it is also probably, you know, I'm an overeducated kind of punk Gen Xer, and I don't like a lot of things. So is that me? Those are feelings that I bet. If we could be in a room, I bet I could name 10 of you who would probably have that feeling, and I would judge you by your age and your clothes and your, you know, culture that you perform. And for a bunch of y'all, I'd probably be right because those ideas are not unique to us, but they live in the culture around us. And this is really something that the Buddha, I think, brilliantly understood. And it's behind this idea of not self. That gets a little complicated. It's not the topic for tonight, but just to touch it, what is it about my, you know, response to these paintings that's really completely mine? So some of it came from all these different places. So I want to know that, really have a feel for that. And in that sense, I'll start to feel how the thoughts that I have, you know, some of these thoughts, I'm kind of hearing them through the, you know, through the historical, cultural unconscious. My kid will do this often. I have an 8-year-old, and lately he's been doing this thing. There's a particular sort of dude attitude that he's picked up at school. And for the record, I'm not fond of it, but he's doing this thing, and it's very kind of hyper performative. And you know, we'll say something. We'll ask him a question that's, you know, completely innocuous, or to us it is. You know, do you want a pickle with your sandwich? You know, but instead of just saying yes or no, he'll say, I can't believe I'm going to do this on camera. He'll say, "Oh yeah, Dubra." And I'm a little like, where did you get that? Because I don't know anybody who talks like this. You know. And he's got this like hyper stylized version of it, and clearly it's going around the playground because a couple of them are sort of doing it. But you know, he has no idea that he's kind of performing a very kind of particular cultural identity. What is that thing? You know, and so we might ask from a Buddhist perspective, is that his? Like, is that him? It came from somewhere, you know, but he's clearly in this moment having the original creative thought that it would be fun to do this kind of gesture thing and say those words. But does he own that? How much of that is him and how much of it is, you know, the cultural mind around him? And so thinking, which is really what I want to focus on tonight, the phenomenon we call thinking, it partly consists of the mind, the attention, the conscious part of our internal life, coming up with threads of content, story, imagery, sounds, words, language that we got from somewhere else. Certainly, almost all the language we talk to ourselves in, you know, is not made up words that are idiosyncratic to us. You probably have a couple of those, but not very many. Mostly, you probably say things to yourself that use the language that you grew up saying, right? Which means that those words are embedded with the way that those words were used by others. So, in a sense, when I say to myself, you know, Any number of, well, anything that I say to myself, if I say to myself like, oh, sweetie, don't be so hard on yourself, right? Well, pick something nice. So I've said that to myself any number of times. When I say to myself, oh, sweetie, who is that? Who is that? And if I really feel into it, I can touch into this way that it's a little bit, it's a little bit my mom. It's a little bit a kind of friend, that sort of friend, almost like a friend's mom that I knew when I was a kid. And it's a little bit kind of like a couple people I knew in my 20s who were very, very sweet and would use language like that. And that somehow the combination of those people and that kind of language landed in me as a thing that I resonate with. I like hearing that from myself. And so I hear that, oh, sweetie, don't be so hard on yourself. And there's a way that partly it's my own thought that I'm doing on purpose to myself. And partly it's a thing that I'm hearing, like in my mind's ear, almost like the resonance of those ancestors. My mom's an ancestor now, bless her. And or those other people are coming to me through the strange medium of memory transformed into something I now say to myself. And so I'm kind of hearing that. So you can start to investigate your thinking as if thinking is a sense, like auditory hearing. I hear somebody say something to me, I say something to myself that was once said to me or reminds me of something else or is a quote from something. And so the thinking is a kind of perceiving. So that's step one here. Does that make sense? I don't know how you can answer me in the weird Zoom format, but if a couple of you sort of nod your heads, I'll be like, yeah, I think that kind of makes sense. So thinking is the sixth of the senses in the lists, in the Dharma. That's one way to think about thinking. And one of the things that's really helpful about thinking about thinking in this way is that it makes it less of a volitional act. It makes it less of a thing that you're doing on purpose. And one of the really interesting things about thinking is that you can think on purpose about something, and you can also try not to think, and your mind will do it anyway. So it's a little bit like breathing in this way, and you can let that blow your mind that these two are very similar in this particular way in a lot of ways. You can breathe a certain way if you want to, right? You can hold your breath. You could take a really long, slow breath. You could breathe really fast. You can go to yoga and do all sorts of weird breaths. I'm calling them weird. They're not weird. I teach them. I love them. I say that as a way to, maybe a better way to say that is you could go to yoga and you could do very, very detailed, particular breaths. How about that? Where it's clear that if you choose to, you can substantially alter your breathing within a certain range. But then, as soon as you stop doing that, as soon as you stop intentionally holding your breath or breathing fast or slow or whatever you're doing, your breath goes back to the thing that it otherwise wants to be doing, which is that it wants to keep going. And it kind of goes back to whatever rhythm it likes. And it keeps going when you're not trying to do it. So breath can be both autonomic, meaning it does it by itself, and volitional. You can do it on purpose or change it on purpose. So thinking is like this. If you don't try to do anything with your thinking, the cognitive faculties do their process of interpreting the world and having feelings about it and perceiving things and recognizing them and naming them and building whole, repeating stories about them, doing the work of understanding the world and our place in it, mapping the world around us. And partly how we map the world around us is we have stories about it, Oh, I like those people and not those. Those people like me and not those. That place is safe. That place is not safe. This place feels comfortable. This place feels uncomfortable. We make a map of them. I'm close to home. I'm far away from home. All of this is part of autonomic thinking. It just happens by itself. The trouble with autonomic thinking is that it's often really emotionally driven, and the emotions are nervous system driven. So, an easy way to think about this is that attention follows intensity. And that's the phrase to remember. Attention follows intensity. So, whatever's most intense around you, that or in you at this moment, that's where your attention is likely to want to go. So, if there's a big drama happening in your friend circle or your family or in yourself in relationship to someone or some situation, it's likely that your attention wants to go there. And that's going to mean that you're going to think about it. So, what is thinking as a sense? It means partly that your attention, the thing you're conscious of, the thing that's in the foreground, is moving toward this aspect of experience. So, my family and I are out in the Sierras. We're at this big gathering right now. There's a lot happening there. And so that's interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff there, interesting people. The room that I'm in right now is a perfectly lovely room. But I just looked around the room to notice more details about what was here. And I noticed that the walls are this kind of light bluish color. And this light blue color, I neither love it nor hate it. It's quite neutral to me. And before I looked around the room here to notice what was neutral here, I hadn't noticed it at all. And my mind has no impulse to think about these walls, right? They're sitting squarely in like neutral space for me. There's not much charge there. There's not much intensity. And so while we were meditating, and I was doing the same instructions I was giving you, when my mind wandered, one of the things it wandered to was back to the campground where my family and I are and the interesting things happening there. It never wandered to the color of the walls here, It never wandered to any number of other things happening in my life that have less charge or interest right now. And so the attention follows intensity. But intensity is largely created by the nervous system sensing either danger or threat or interest. So, something that you really like or you really dislike, something that's frightening or something that's really entrancing, that's intensity. And so, we perceive intensity mostly emotionally, I think. It's kind of the layer that it comes in. But some of you will be familiar with the foundation of mindfulness called Vedana or feeling tone. Pleasant, unpleasant. And this is simpler than feelings. It's not like joyful, sad, happy, grieving, heartbroken. It's really just pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And so everything resonates for us slightly as one of these. Most things are relatively neutral, unless you're really having a hard time or really a great time. But probably for you, most things are relatively in the neutral zone. And that means that it's not so easy to keep the attention on them. The attention wants to go to the things that are more at the extremes, the super wonderful stuff, right? Remember falling in love, if you ever did that, or really, really getting into something, whatever it was. Your attention goes there a lot, right? There's a lot of intensity there. There's a really strong feeling there. Or if something terrible has happened to you, and undoubtedly something has, because you're here in the human realm where terrible things happen all the time, terrible things happen and your mind has gone to them, right? Sometimes when a terrible thing is really close by, it's nearly impossible to bring the mind anywhere else, right? Because the nervous system is trying to say, like, there's danger here. Pay attention. Right? Keep yourself safe. Pay attention. So the natural impulse to stay safe also becomes the natural impulse to obsess over what's wrong. Those two are intimately connected. So the fact that I can't keep my mind, still in meditation because I keep worrying, I'm not doing that on purpose, right? But that some part of my nervous system, my cognitive system, my emotional system is telling me something feels dangerous, right? Pay attention to this thing. So thinking as an autonomic process is intimately connected with the nervous system's sense of what feels safe or dangerous. And it's intimately connected with the emotional system of what has intensity, either intense positive or intense negative charge. This is why, even when we, choose to focus our attention on something, somewhere we want to think about, it's sometimes hard to do so. Of course, you're like, duh, I know this. I wrote a PhD once upon a time, and there were all sorts of times when sitting down to write yet another 10 pages in this extremely long pile of pages, was not the most interesting thing going on in my life. In the middle of my PhD, I had a baby. And what was going on with him and with my partner was way more interesting, both in the positive and negative, directions. Like there was way more intensity there than there was in my slow process of, looking up yet another reference and writing another proper footnote for yet another page of, philosophically accurate analytical text. Meh, right? And so then what did I have to do? I had to bring my attention to this thing that was not the most intense content present. And that took focus, right? So I had to really make myself do it. And I work best under deadline, partly because the deadline increases, some of you will know this very well, the deadline increases the emotional intensity in the room, and suddenly it's possible to bring my attention there. Right? If the deadline is close enough, it becomes more intense than the other thing that your attention wants to go to. And so in meditation, in the same way as, doing a big writing project or any other thing that you have to make your mind do, we are, but particularly in meditation, I think, we are asking our mind, our cognitive faculties, our attention, to stabilize on something that by design is non-stimulating. Right? And if the breath is super stimulating, it's probably because there's either been some trauma, there's some breath trauma, so it can stir up energy, or you're trying to make too much of it. The breath and the body, in a certain way, are by design good anchors for meditation because they're not supposed to be all that intense. The breath is happening all the time, the body has sensations all the time. And that means that our training in meditation is very centrally trying to get the attention to do something that it doesn't really want to do. The attention wants to go somewhere interesting, to the dramas in your life. And instead, we're saying, set those down for a bit and stay with this rising and falling breath. So there's a couple ways that we can work with this. One of the main ways that, and the Buddha suggests this is really core to the practice of meditation as the Buddha described it. One of the main pathways is that settling into the body and breath in a really relaxed, like somatically present way, present with bodily energy and sensation in a good way. This is actually supposed to relatively soon, don't take that as a way to blame yourself if you've been working on this for 40 years and it hasn't felt good that much yet. And it undoubtedly must have, or else you would have stopped. But meditation is supposed to feel good. It's supposed to feel restful, pleasurable, and it's supposed to give rise to very pleasurable energies in the body mind. Pleasurable energy is called rapture. It's a translation of the Pali word piti. pleasurable emotional energies like well-being and happiness called sukha. And the simple pleasure of tranquility, of the mind being a little quiet. So one of the pathways to go for is to find a relaxed, relatively quiet mind, and a sweet, relaxed sense in the body for long enough or strong enough. And those are a little bit interchangeable. If it's weak, stretch it out a little longer. If it's strong, you can notice this quicker. Long enough or strong enough to notice that you like it. Because the pleasure of liking the meditation, of liking being calm and centered, that can become strong enough that it becomes much easier to stay with it, right? If attention follows intensity, one thing that's possible, especially if you don't have super big extremes going on, if you're not, distracted by being madly in love or distracted by being really, really in a trauma vortex, if you're just kind of trying to be, if you're kind of in the middle and everything's going okay and you're a little bit bored or whatever, right? Not too intense. The pleasure of relaxing into meditation can be enough to bring you more easily there and less distracted, right? So you want to make the breath and body interesting enough that you want to stay there. And the longer you stay, the more continuous the attention is with the body and breath, the more pleasurable it tends to get. And again, this is not necessarily in any individual sitting. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But over the arc of practice, one of our goals in meditation can be to really enjoy it, to really connect with the body breathing and resting into sensation and being in the here and now and relaxing through the whole body in a way that just feels good. And it's meant to feel good. So let's say that's the easy pathway. And it's not easy, but that's the pathway that can feel like ease once you hook into it, once you've got a little momentum in that direction. But you might say, that sounds great if you can do it, but my mind is a mess, And so the Buddha says, okay, so here you go. You've got this mind. You want to settle it down into a calm, relaxed, pleasurable state, and you just can't. So what do you do? And all of this builds on the recognition that attention following intensity is not entirely volitional. You can't just tell your mind to do something and it stays there. And why that is the case, I wish it were otherwise. I could just say to you, wouldn't it be amazing if you could just say, mind, stick with this task that I have to do till it's done, and the mind would be like, okay. Or you could say, mind, just settle into the body and breath and relax and stop obsessing about da, 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 da. And it would be like, okay, and just stay there, right? Like your life, everything about your life would be different if you could control the mind in that way. And so the whole process of meditation, in a way, is to work with the mind that is unruly, that is outside of volitional control. And so the Buddha, in one beautiful discourse, gives five methods for dealing with the mind. So this is where I'm headed tonight. Your mind doesn't do what you want it to do. What do you do about that? And so this discourse, this is one of the chapters or discourses, suttas, in the middle-length discourses. It's called the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's discourse number 20 in the middle-length discourses. And in some translations, in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, it's called the removal of distracting thoughts. In the translation that I'm going to post in the chat here for you, or Emiko will, there it is. Translation by an Australian monastic named Bhikkhu Sujato, for free on the Sutta Central website, which is a beautiful, beautiful resource for reading the discourses. He just calls it how to stop thinking. So that's fairly straightforward. So this talk that the Buddha gives goes through five tools that you can use to quiet the thinking mind when you want to quiet it down. So, some of what's implied here is that, of course, it's not always necessary to stop thinking. Like, thinking is useful. Thinking when you're doing it on purpose or you're aiming it in a direction that it's helpful, is a beautiful and helpful thing to do, right? I wasn't trying to stop thinking when I was writing my dissertation. I was just trying to only think about dissertation things, right? That's what the focus was. When you're having a close conversation with somebody who's important to you, your goal is not to stop thinking. Your goal is to channel your emotional and cognitive and affective and verbal, power toward what you're actually doing, what you actually want to be doing. So really listening and then really speaking and really thinking about what you're saying. So thinking is wonderful when it's serving you, when it's doing wholesome work. And when it's not, the training is to, colloquially, we might say, get it to shut the F up, So that's the work here. I say it strongly like that because this group of tools is going to get to that. But it starts off gentle. When I had an infant, there was some, we read any number of parenting books, which, I think is one does nowadays when one has children, because who else is going to tell you how to do things, right? Your parents? I don't know. They didn't for me. So we read parenting books. And one of the pieces of advice that I really liked was that when something's happening and you need to intervene, you start off with the gentlest intervention possible. And you only make the intervention more intense when the gentle one doesn't work. First you just say, oh, sweetheart, we don't run with scissors. And then you say, sweetie, put the scissors down, and then it accelerates un until you're like, until, you know, un until parents are like, stop, you startle them and you're like, put the scissors down and back away from your baby brother, whatever. Like you start off as gentle as needed, and then you accelerate, you intensify only as necessary. So there's a ladder of intervention. So this is the Buddha's ladder of intervention for the thinking mind. And I love it so much. I made a what's it called? The for where the first letter of each thing is a makes a word. It's a anagram? No, what is it? I don't know. The word for those things. So mine is the word, it's an acrostic. Thank you very much. So the word is RAISE, RAISE. It's an acronym. Both of those work. It's an acronym. I think that's the correct word. So it's an acronym. The acronym is RAISE, RAISE. And the words are replace, assess, ignore, still, and like eject or erase, so replace. So step one, this is the gentlest intervention. When there's an unwholesome thought, the Buddha says, and you want to get rid of it, replace it with a more wholesome one. So some of the common ways we do this are when we do the practice of bringing the mind back from distraction, and we bring into the mind a word that helps land the attention back here. So my mind has been wandering to something. I notice that it's been wandering. So mindfulness has kicked in. I come back and I notice the in-breath and I say, breathing in, breathing out. So I replace the thought of whatever it was, worrying about whatever, with the thought, now I am breathing in. And You can do this without words or with words. It's going to be stronger with words because you're replacing words with words. So sometimes the thought, the worried thought has a kind of emotional charge where there's often like some unkindness to it. Say you're judging yourself, something like that. Some folks like to bring the attention back and replace it with loving kindness. So maybe you bring it back with a loving kindness phrase, may I be well, may I be at ease. And so that can meet the energy, the intensity of the distracting thought with a corresponding emotional intensity, right? Oh, sweetie, it's okay, right? It's okay, you're okay. So you replace the unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought. And in a way, this is what we do all the time. This is the usual meditation instruction. Just come back. Don't be hard on yourself. Reestablish with your anchor. So you're replacing, and again, it doesn't have to be a thought, but you're really redirecting attention. And so the R could also be redirect, right? But in the discourse, it's specifically replace. And the discourse gives similes, little pictorial examples for each of these. And the simile for this first one is of a carpenter taking out a coarse peg by means of a finer one. So if you want to knock a peg out of a piece of wood, you get a peg that's smaller than it and you hammer it in. So then it kind of knocks it out but doesn't get stuck itself, right? So you take a wholesome thought and you use it to knock out an unwholesome thought. So that's step one. That's the gentlest intervention. The discourse goes on to say, okay, well, if that's not working, then maybe you need something stronger. And the step two, the A in raise, I call assess. And so this is examine that thought and see whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. And mostly I find that if the thought is really sticky, it's probably unwholesome or unskillful, but not necessarily. Like sometimes it can be a wholesome thought, like I'm super inspired about the Dharma. And I just can't stop thinking about this wonderful Dharma talk that I heard from this wonderful teacher. And that's great, right? That's a wholesome thing. But it's not the right time to be thinking about that because I'm meditating. And so, or maybe I maybe someone commented, so you might be like, well, I am in fact falling in love, or I did at one time and it's the best thing ever. And reflecting on love is wholesome. So that's great. But maybe it's just not the right time for that. So you reflect on the wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of the thought. And you could also, with the wholesome, you reflect on the timeliness of it. And the idea with this one is that if you really see, and I think by that it really means really feel, that a certain thought pattern, let's say, is unwholesome. So let's say that you're worrying about something and you notice, oh, it's worry. The assess stage is you really get in touch with like, oh, worry is not helpful. It's not useful, right? Like I'm kind of just churning over the same story over and over. It's not making me any more calm and I'm not figuring it out because it's usually what happens. You don't figure it out. So not wholesome, not helpful. And the idea really is that you want to be free of suffering. You want to be in wholesome states. And so when you notice that you have a state going on that's unwholesome, that's going to be a support for you setting it down. It's kind of, the idea is kind of like it was bewitching you a bit. The worry was making me think that if I think about it hard enough, I'm going to figure it out. And that's positive. That feels positive. I think I'm doing a good thing. But actually, you're like, oh, this is actually not helpful. I'm not going to figure it out. It's not helping me out. So, can I just let it go? So step two, or intervention number two, is assess. So you examine it, you notice that it results to suffering, and as you do that, it dies away. And the simile for this one is kind of an extreme image. So there you go. The simile is of a young, attractive person who loves being beautiful and is fond of ornamentation. If they suddenly notice that instead of a beautiful necklace or some gorgeous, like, adornment or some awesome shirt that you are very happy to wear, you found like the carcass of a dead dog or a rotting snake around your neck, and you would be horrified and disgusted, right? So this thing that you're really into being beautiful, but actually suddenly there's like a dead snake around your neck, and it's really disgusting. The Buddha says it's like that. You notice that you're having a thought. You actually notice that it's unwholesome, and you're like, "Ooh, get this thing off of me." So that's intervention number two. So R, replace A, assess for wholesome and unwholesome. The third, I, is okay. Let's say that's still not working, the Buddha says, then just ignore it. So that's turn your attention to something else. Don't try to stop it, but just don't give it any attention. I think we naturally do this a lot, particularly when we get the instruction to just let thought be as it is and bring the attention to somewhere else. But when the thought is intense, it's really hard to do this, actually, to ignore it, right? And so I think to ignore, the main thing that I have to do anyway is I have to bring something else very strongly into my center of focus. I have to kind of do a more forceful version of replace. I'm going to really focus on the breath. I'm going to sit up really tall and be like, no, I'm not thinking about you anymore. I'm just doing just this. And I have to kind of forcefully ignore it. I did say that I was a Gen Xer, and so some of you may have seen this horror movie from back in the day, Nightmare on Elm Street, where this like demon in people in teenagers' dreams like kills them in real life. Anyway, so but at the climax of one of the movies, the heroine, the last girl in the movie, she has gone into the dream realm to try to get the killer, and she kind of grabs a hold of him and drags him, like out of the dream realm into the waking realm. And she wakes up in her bed and she's like, oh, he wasn't real. She looks around, he's not here, he wasn't real, I'm free of it. And then as she goes to leave the room, she can hear movement behind her, and she knows that he is actually in the room with her here. And she forces herself to not look, and she says, you are not real. And she ignores him, and he almost sort of makes it to her, but the force of her ignoring him, it was enough, and he disappears in kind of back into the dream realm. And so that's my simile. That's my Gen X simile for ignore, is Freddy Krueger. But the proper simile here is just closing your eyes and looking away. It says, suppose there was a person with clear eyes and some undesirable sights came into their range of vision. They would just close their eyes or look away. And so ignore is just look away. Just don't go there. So again, it's interesting that this one's more intense than replace and assess, but it actually takes a fair amount of force in the mind to do this. So this is the next intense method. So S, RAIS, S is still or silence. And in this one, and again, these are increasing in intensity, right? So you don't always need to do these, but this one, again, the discourse says if it's still bothering you, right, and none of those methods have worked, you could do this. And this message is just make it shut up. Like just quiet it down. And you can do this gently. You don't have to be mean about it to yourself. Please don't. But sometimes, it just keeps coming back. And I might just say internally, shh. Just quiet. Quiet, you thing. And again, this can be like replace, right? You're replacing the story, whatever it is, the distracting thought, with silence. But because it's silence, because you're not replacing it with another thought or looking towards something else, Again, it takes a little bit more force. I love this one myself because I really love silence. And I actually like doing this a little bit as a preliminary in the beginning of a meditation. I will just forcibly like quiet everything that's going on, and I'll hold silence for a little while in the mind. The way that I do this is I practice listening to silence. And so not listening to other sounds around, like you could turn your attention to the birds singing or the sound of the fan in the room or something else. That's different. That's replace. It's totally wholesome. Please do that. Listening to silence in the mind is more like noticing the absence of thought and focusing on that. So noticing the absence of it's usually words or images, and words are more often more distracting than it, but sometimes an image is really nagging at you. If any of you ever saw that horror movie, I may have replanted that image in your mind and it will nag you for a little bit. Sorry about that. Apologize. Images can do that. Watch your media intake, seriously, people and your kids, for that exact reason, because images like that show up in Dharma talks 40 years later because you saw them when you were 13. And so that happens. But you can focus on silence in the mind as an object, and doing that, and again, you have to maintain your focus on it. It takes some energy, but you can do that in a way that just quiets whatever's there. You're like quiet, and then hold that quiet. And for all of these rely on the basic quality and attention that you can direct it and you can sustain it. But the sustain fades away, kind of like striking a piano key. You strike it, you get an initial loud sound, and then it immediately starts to fade away. So whenever you turn your attention towards something, you can stick it to it for a moment, and then as you sustain your attention there, the intensity or the energy is going to start dropping away, usually. And so very often, after a little bit of falling away, you have to reestablish. Right, so I reestablish energy on the breath, attention on the breath, every time it goes around for a while. Rather than, because if you get too passive, it'll just drift away. Again, remember, we're trying to pay attention to something that's more neutral than the thing that's trying to pull us away, which is more intense. So you have to reestablish attention a lot more on the breath and the body than you do on worry. Worry, you trip into it, and then you just spend a half an hour there without even trying. Because it holds intensity. The breath, you might have to reconnect with it every turn of the breath for a while, or several times within one breath. So all of this depends on, establishing attention the place you want it to be and then sustaining it there. And the silence one, you might just have to do establish it a lot, like really listen for the silence. And again, and again, and again. And you again. With all of these, and I'll start to say this even more at this level of intensity, try to do this in a relaxed way. Try to forcefully direct your mind, but in a relaxed, calm, like pleasurable, being kind to yourself kind of way. Right? Don't add tension to the process. There's enough already, just in the worry or the distracting thought. All right. So to get to the end here, the E is expel, get rid or eject, get rid of it. And okay, wait, first of all, the simile for stilling, for the silencing, the stilling simile the Buddha gives is of a person who is running and thinks, why am I running? Why don't I just walk? That would be more peaceful. And then they think, why am I walking? Why don't I just stand? And then they think, why am I standing when I could sit? And then they think, why am I sitting? Why don't I just lay down? And so bit by bit, they're like, well, that do the easier thing, right? Like, and then they just do less and less and less and less until they're lying down. And that's really peaceful. Remember that meditation is supposed to be pleasurable and peaceful. So that's where we're headed. So that's the simile for stilling, is progressively lying down. So to get to the end, the E, expel, this is the one we are contractually obligated to tell you as teachers that not to do this too often, and to do it, to be gentle to yourself when you do it. But I'll just quote it to you from the sutta because it's fun, in a certain way. It says, suppose that practitioner is focusing on stopping the formation of thoughts, but bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. That's, by the way, the definition of the distracting thoughts we're trying to stop, is bad, unskillful thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion. They keep coming up. So then, this is again, this is your last final option. With teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, they should squeeze, squash, and crush mind with mind. They should squeeze, squash, and crush mind with mind. So this is the, and the simile is just as a strong man would take a weaker man by the arm or the head and squeeze, squash, crush, and contain, constrain him, so too should do that mind with mind. This is the, like, this is the most forceful, this is the parent yelling stop. This is the moment when you're just like, it is not serving me to keep going with this pattern. And you use the force of your will essentially to shut it up. And you just say stop to yourself. Now, of course, the thing about the force of will is that, like playing a piano note really strongly, it'll startle you, but it still fades away. And you can't reestablish that stop, because then you're just yelling at your kid for an hour, right? It only works as a startle. And so you tell your mind, stop. And then everything stops. Partly because you told your nervous system that something dangerous was happening, right? Remember that whole bit about attention following intensity. You can stop a distracting thought by creating intensity. There's lots of meditation methods that do this, right? Beware some of those. But this is one where, like, yeah, create intensity. Say stop. Nervous system stops. You're like, what? And and your mind's a little bit going like, what's going on? And you're like, this is not good for me. But then what you have to do is you have to back down the ladder of intensity. If you yell stop to your kid, mostly what happens is they stop and then they start crying because you really scared them, And then you put the scissors down and then you go all the way back to the beginning and you say, come here, sweetie, give me a hug. Let's reconnect. And so if you do the bear down and crush mind with mind intervention on yourself, you say, stop. Then you got to go all the way back to, maybe you go all the way back to loving kindness, and you're like, oh, sweetheart, it is so hard sometimes. It's okay. We're going to start over, And the point of the whole thing is not to, like, control the mind per se, but is actually to unlearn the ancient, conditioning and traumas that give rise to obsessive, unwholesome thought. To unlearn, patterns of oppression, patterns of addiction, to unlearn, all of that that causes the mind to obsessively worry and fret and fantasize. With the goal of resting the mind in a pleasurable and peaceful, present state, the heart and the body really here, really available for the work then of understanding and coming to a deeper peace. So I hope this is helpful. Five methods for stopping distracting thought, and a new acronym for you, RAISE. Raise your vibration or something. I'm not sure what exactly we're raising, but replace, assess, ignore, still, expel. And the sutta is Majjhima 20, so I encourage you to go and read it. And and play with this in your meditation practice. Particularly, it's particularly for silent meditation, but you can abstract these to other things in your life. And so we have a few minutes here for any clarifying questions or reflections here. You can raise your electronic hand or drop questions into the chat. And the question is, stopping the quote from the sutta is stopping unwholesome or unskillful thoughts. Essentially, they are grasping aversion and delusion, or greed, hate, and delusion, or desire or lust, hatred, ill will, delusion, some variation of that. A question about the six senses. Is the mind including thoughts and consciousness, or just thoughts? It's all of it, and it's more than that. It's not only thoughts and consciousness, like the sense of being aware of something. All of that is contained within the mind sense, but it's also emotions. And this is important to remember, that in the Buddhist understanding, the organ of cognition, it's called the citta, in Pali, it refers to the inner seat, as it were, of all inner content. And that means both the emotional aspect of things, like the feeling tone is in the mind, the pleasantness, unpleasantness, which is kind of somatic, really, but it's a kind of cognitive sense. The emotional sense of something being, my reaction to it being happy or sad or any of the variation of emotions, that's also considered mind here. And so a lot of people will hyphenate heart mind, or mind heart, or body heart mind, but the main distinction is that it's everything that is in the processing and understanding realm. So sense consciousness, narrative, so story, thinking, but also emotions, energy that has an emotional side, all of that is considered mind here. So it's still mind, right? So the questioner says, what about doing something like, saying a mantra, saying, metta phrases, being positive with ourselves? All of that is mind. And doing all of those things is a version of this first intervention, right? Replace. So you're replacing worry with a mantra, or with metta phrases, or with, shifting something into the positive. All of that is a version of replace here. Kimberly, please. You can unmute and speak, or as you like.
Thank you. I want to say how valuable this has been, and I so appreciate the subtleties of your commentary during the meditation, particularly about emotional tone and what story was taking us away. And I really had an epiphany to see with even more depth that the story that I have grown up in and lived from is fighting injustice. I grew up in the Vietnam War. I grew up protesting nuclear reactors and all kinds of things. And so there was all this justification of righteousness, but it has caused this persistent modus operandi of anger. And so when someone really sees a life pattern like that, do you have any suggestions for how it's so strong, the habit of that conditioning? And I'm in my 60s now. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, first of all, as someone younger than you in that history, thank you for your activism and your caring and your work in those times. That work was so necessary, and it helped build so much of the goodness in the world that we live in now. So those of us that are activists now and retreading some of those same topics, because greed, hatred, and delusion never go away, we are indebted to the work that you all did then. So thank you for that. And it's true, then as now, that responding to injustice and oppression, one of the natural responses is anger. So in that sense, it's not necessarily unwholesome, depending on how it's used and the context. But the way that you're speaking about it, and it's true for a lot of folks, it can, anger that can begin as a righteous and appropriate response to what's wrong in the world can become lodged in the heart and really can become an internal suffering.
Yeah,
It's
it
no
does
longer
cause suffering.
mobilizing you towards a certain action necessarily. Maybe sometimes it does, but any of those emotions, when they get stuck in the heart, they can just they can cause and they're not leading to well-being any longer. And so part of working with them, I think, can begin with respecting them as appropriate, that they were once, well attuned and appropriate. Maybe they're differently attuned now, at times have changed, they're not in use in the same way. But to honor those parts of yourself, that you were in good communities, that you did good work. And that in doing so, perhaps to th this might be a version of, replacing a certain story with a more wholesome version of that story, to say to this part of yourself, like we did something, that was important. And now, it's been this work has been passed to the next generation who care. I'm handing it over. And there can be really a like, I'm setting this down, this force that was in me for reasons. I'm ready to set it down and be in another part of my life. And so that's one, potential pathway. That could be a whole, that could be years of ritual and letting go and, work on. Or it could be as simple as shifting how you feel this emotion when it comes. A different pathway, might be just to, not even get into the social or cultural complexities in that way, but just to come at it now purely as a practitioner, where your priority is your own well-being, your own happiness, your own depth of peace in your heart, and that's what you're committed to. And so then when this energy or emotion comes up, you can you can treat it like a distracting thought, but in a very tender way, that this was really part of yourself and it has been part of your world. And without so much commentary about it, you can just say, like, enough.
But the truth is that those causes, if anything, have worsened. There's even more environmental concern, and the oppression and the injustice and the suffering has increased. So I don't see letting that down, but how can I not, how can I find that peace and still work towards justice in the world, I think is the dilemma.
Absolutely. There is no peace without putting it down. Now, I'm not saying to put down working for justice, only putting down hatred.
Oh, I see. So that's the key part to dismantle.
That's
And
right.
it isn't so much the hatred as it is the anger at the oppression and the injustice.
The anger, as long as it's not serving you, like if it's causing suffering, then it has to be put down if you want to be free of it.
I see.
I think it's really a piece of work for activists to who turn towards spirit or toward the Dharma to figure out how to find motivation for activist work, for movement work, that's not anger.
And the activists need to know how to be activists without becoming overwhelmed with anger and hatred.
That's right. That's right.
The
There's
world needs this information right now more than ever.
absolutely, absolutely. And there's a there's there are beautiful forms of very fiery righteousness that, that burn hot in the culture, but don't burn the heart of the one who moves that energy. And I think that that is when, and it's hard to do, no doubt, but to be moving in the world as best we can from generosity, from compassion, from wisdom.
We need a website for that. Can you make one for that with practices, with videos, things that can be shared on Instagram? I'm saying this is critical. This is what's going to turn the tide. This is how the
Absolutely.
activism from the past can mutate into the one that will achieve the magnitude of salvation that we need right now.
I think that you're absolutely right. I think there's a ton of good work going on in this way. And, it's my hope as a teacher of the Dharma, who, I count as my Dharma ancestors, some of the most inspiring, Buddhist activists of this century,
Thich Nhat Hanh, yes.
And Suluk Sivaraksha and Dr. Aryaratne, who just passed a couple weeks ago, the founder of Sarvodaya in Sri Lanka, and many, many, many good folks. Our elder Joanna Macy, still with us at 95 years old or something. So much good work. My teacher Tanisara doing beautiful, beautiful work in the intersection of Dharma and activism. And the people that really, I think, inspire in this realm is are the ones who figure out how to not move from anger alone, but really to move from radical compassion, from really the very beautiful positive states of mind, and still move in the world, still make move the work of building a better world forward and move the
And a
movement.
passionate love for our planet and its preciousness and our nature, like Jane Goodall and David Attenborough. And but if you do have any resources for us, can you place them in the chat, or are they available on your website?
Let me see. There totally are, and we're at time. I don't have time to put things in chat immediately. What's a good way to do this?
On your website, perhaps.
Go to my I'm trying to be brief here because we're a little bit past time. You know what? There's so much good stuff. I'm going to give you just one because a lot of the things that have been named here are very widely known. But I'm going to tell you the website of my teacher Tanisara, and you can start there and follow the threads from there. Her group is called Sacred Mountain Sangha.
Okay.
Many of us at Spirit Rock and elsewhere study with her, and she's a beautiful teacher, Sacred Mountain Sangha.
Thank
And
you.
the one other that I'll mention is Joanna Macy's organization or lineage, which is called The Work That Reconnects.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kimberly. Blessings to you. We're a bit after our time, so we do have to pause. If you want to come and hang out with me more and talk more, have more questions and things like that, I teach every Tuesday evening, and you can find my sitting group on my website, which is my name, seanfiteoaks.com, and you can find me through the Spirit Rock website. And I'm around. I'm guest teaching at Rick Hansen's group next Wednesday. You'll find that on his website or mine. And I'm teaching a study series through Spirit Rock starting at the end of May. And we will look closely again at Majjhima 20 and some of the other discourses on working with the mind, working toward concentration, working to deepen meditation. So thank you all for being here. And come find me elsewhere for more questions and discussion, and I hope to see you again. So blessings and take good care. May our practice be for ourselves and for all beings a blessing of peace, of the end of war, and of profound well-being in all ways for all beings everywhere. All right, thank you so much. Thank you, Emiko, for hosting us. See you again.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate. donate.